Possible by the U of I's Center for Advanced Study, whose MillerCom 2005 lecture series presents The Past and the Internet by Jeffrey Bowker, Regis and Diane McKenna, Chair and Executive Director, Center for Science, Technology, and Society, Santa Clara University, on Thursday, February 28th at 4 p.m. at the Levis Faculty Center. For more information, go to www.cas.uiuc.edu. Programs on WILL are made possible in part by a grant from Christopher's Fine Jewelry Design, a gallery of imaginative jewelry and gifts in downtown Champaign, offering one-of-a-kind custom design, gemstone round tables, and conflict-free diamonds direct from Canada.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Today we're going to take a glimpse inside the world of science of the Victorian age and one of its biggest controversies, the origin of coral reefs. The controversy involves three main characters, Charles Darwin and father and son naturalists, Lewis and Alexander Agassiz. Darwin and Louis Agassiz were giants in the world of science in the 19th century. Agassiz was a star paleontologist. He taught at Harvard. He was a founding member of a number of important bodies, including the Smithsonian and the National Academy of Sciences. Agassiz, however, did not share Darwin's theory of natural selection. That cost him his reputation as a scientist. Now, the two giants aside, the central character of the story we'll hear about today is Lewis's son, Alexander. He was, as we will hear, a very different man than his father. While Alexander shared Darwin's view of natural selection, he, like his father before him, found himself in disagreement with Darwin. The conflict? The coral reef problem. Our guest this afternoon is writer David Dobbs. His latest book is Reef Madness, Charles Darwin, Alexander Agassiz, and the Meaning of Coral. Listeners, you can join the discussion this afternoon with your questions and comments. Join us with a telephone call in the Champaign-Urbana area. The number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Our guest, David Dobbs' book, Reef Madness, is published by Pantheon. David Dobbs, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thanks for having me.
The coral reef debate was a hot one, and we'll look at why it became such a hot potato probably later in the interview, but here at the outset, would you tell us when this debate began and when it became so contentious?
This is a very long-running debate that really started in the 1770s when Captain James Cook took his round-the-world voyage and came back to Britain and Europe with the first tales in Europe of encounters with coral reefs. And it was a mystery how, at first, even what corals were, and in the first 50 years or so, by the turn of the century into the 19th century, they had figured out that corals were very tiny little animals and that the reefs were the kind of a crude skeletons of millions of these animals. So they knew what the corals were, and by the early 1800s, they knew that they could grow only in shallow water in the tropics. What they didn't know was why the reefs took their unique, roughly circular shapes, and they also did not know how they came to grow. They could not explain the platforms on which the reefs grew. This was the great mystery, because most of the Pacific coral reefs grow on peaks, summits of platforms that drop away fairly steeply thousands of feet to some of the Pacific's greatest depths. So the great mystery was how do these shallow water organisms build these great reefs atop these structures, or rather, how did the foundations come to be? Did the reefs grow up on top of existing mountains, or did they somehow build their own foundations? And this was something that was very difficult to explain for a number of reasons. A number of different theories got brought up and then had doubt cast upon them. And it was in this long-running debate, lasted well over a century, that Alexander Agassiz came to halfway through his life, and sometime after his father had had his great struggle with Charles Darwin.
Yeah. As I mentioned in my introduction, Lewis was a giant in science in the 19th century, but as you note, he lost his scientific credibility when he rejected Darwin's theory of natural selection and held on to his view of creation. What was his view of the genesis of the species? This is Louis Agassiz.
Well, Louis Agassiz's view was like that of most of his peers who came of age in the early 1800s, like Darwin, who was about Louis's age. Most of that generation were creationists in their view of how species got here. And there was nothing at all unscientific about that. There was not a sharp clash then between a creation or deistic view of species, in other words, the opinion or the belief that God created the species more or less as we find them today. Most naturalists thought that then. Agassiz's mentor, the great Cuvier, the greatest naturalist of his generation, was of this mind, and Agassiz took Cuvier's view from him and expanded on it very eloquently. And if Louis was not unusual in his basic belief that the species as we find them were created that way by God, he was very unusual in his ability to dramatize and to explain how that was and explain what he saw as the evidence for this deistic or creationistic view of species generation. He had a very, very beautiful lecture which led to his great fame in the United States called The Plan of Creation. And you hear echoes of this now in theories that people call intelligent design. His basic point was that if you look at all the different species in the world and the different kinds that you have, animals and plants, you have sea animals, and you see a lot of patterns that cross great divides from land to ocean and so on. You see animals shaped in spirals. You see flowers shaped in spirals. You see both animals and plants who entrap prey in the same way. Many different similarities of great beauty, and he believed that this could only, so much variation, yet so much pattern, could only be the work of a supreme single intelligence. So that was his view, and he rose to a fame that most of us today find hard to imagine for a scientist. I mean, there's lots of very famous people these days, but few that match the combination of professional respect and public adoration that Louis Agassiz had in his day. The only real competition, as it were, he has in American history for that combination would be Benjamin Franklin and then perhaps Albert Einstein. And like Einstein, he was an immigrant. He came to the United States as an adult, and his foreignness was an important part of his charm, I think, and his appeal to the American public early in that century.
Yeah, he was the right man at the right time on the right continent.
He really was, because he was a man of just really boundless charm, whether it was one-on-one or in a room with an audience of 5,000 people. He absolutely wowed people, both the intelligentsia and working people who came, textile workers who came by the hundreds to his lectures in Massachusetts. And I think part of that was because he espoused such a really democratic, populist view of what it was to do good science. He stressed that a dedicated amateur who was devoted to doing rigorous field work could contribute as much to scientists as the most schooled professional. Study life, not books, was one of his mottos. And this had great appeal to a country that, you have to remember what kind of country America was then. It was still a very young country, only a few decades old as an independent republic, and we utterly lacked the sort of intellectual infrastructure, if you would, that Europe had. We did not have the great, long-established universities. We did not have a well-established system of training new professionals and scientists. Many of our scientists would get some education here and then go to Europe to complete it and then perhaps return. But he brought in his foreignness, if you will, an intellectual credibility that was important to his appeal. So he really combined the credibility of Europe with the kind of vitality of spirit and the democratic spirit of the United States. And this made him, along with his great personal charm and incredible intellect, really an irresistible figure.
Mm. David Dobbs is our guest this afternoon here on The Afternoon Magazine. We're talking with him about his book, Reef Madness, Charles Darwin, Alexander Agassiz, and the Meaning of Coral. We have a listener waiting to talk with us in Champaign on line one. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Yes, I'm quite perplexed by your glowing praise of Louis Agassiz. If I remember correctly, it is well known that he founded the bogus science of craniology, that he would go around and measure the crania of different races of people, figuring that could tell him something about their levels of intelligence, and sure enough came up with a hierarchy that at the top of the list, the most intelligent people were white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, and as the list went down, the darker your skin got, until the bottom of the list, of course, were African Americans. It was total racist garbage, certainly at that time and even today in retrospect. And as a matter of fact, Louis Agassiz has been completely debunked as a scientist by the late Harvard biologist Stephen Jay Gould in his book, The Mismeasure of Man, and also by the current Alexander Agassiz, professor of biology and zoology at Harvard, Richard C. Lewontin, who is the world's leading population biologist. So I really think that our listening audience has to be very skeptical about any praise here for a well-known racist and charlatan by the name of Louis Agassiz.
I take your point. I don't know if you're still there, but you're... If I may beg your indulgence, I think you're getting ahead of my story here. You are right in pointing out that Louis, he did not found craniology, but he was an advocate of it. And he his great dark spot, if you would, as a scientist, no pun intended, was his support of that for a racist agenda. And he... Much of his science, particularly his support of evolution, has been disproven and fallen into disfavor. His reputation as a taxonomist, though, and as a popularizer of science, still remains today. And I am not here on either on the radio or certainly in my book to hold up Louis as a model of science. The book, indeed, looks at what happens when Louis's his fondness of speculation and some of the theories that he created in which he stretched the data, his theory of species creation being one example and his theory of phrenology or craniology another, the book looks at what happens when he overextends himself in support of those theories without the evidence. Because the book really is about an argument, that over coral reefs as well as that over evolution, about how to do science. And Louis represented in spectacularly attractive fashion one mode of doing science that was displaced during the 19th century by another mode. And when I speak of him in superlatives, I certainly don't mean to suggest that he is still held as a sort of icon of scientific method today. Indeed, the very first pages of the book point out that his reputation as a scientist even today more or less outrun his actual list of accomplishments.
Yeah, and I think that that's an important part of the story here is about the changes that occurred in science at this point. And Louis Agassiz, he stretched the data, he made great leaps of imagination, and that was that kind of inquiry, that kind of doing, that way of, that approach to science was looked down upon by his own son.
It was, and what you have here really in that conflict is one of the central conflicts of science, which is how the struggle to come up with sound ways of creating scientific theories. And science really is the development of science over the last few centuries is essentially the development of the empirical method, that is, a method of thinking in which you your science, your assertions, the laws you assert are supported by the facts, that you can point to something objective, an objective fact or observation on which others can agree to support your theory. Now, this this was a struggle that went on and on. It's essentially a tension between lovely stories, if you would, and show me the facts, ma'am. So that you had, in Copernicus's time, a tension between one story, which is that the Earth stood at the center of the universe, a story that met many of our needs in one way, and some observational facts about the movement of heavenly bodies as observed from Earth that conflicted with that story. Later you had, in Darwin's time, one story about how species were created that conflicted with the facts that Darwin and many other naturalists of his time were collecting and interpreting in a new light that was determined to explain things according to natural causes. And this tension runs throughout. And in the 19th century in particular, the scientific establishment was more and more determined to prove things in the most rigorous empirical manner possible. And this is why Louis lost his argument with Charles Darwin, is because by the time all the debates were over, his peers concluded that while Louis's story was very lovely, and that while Louis thought it was supported by the evidence of the varieties of life, the more naturalistic, evidence-based explanation was found in Darwin's book, The Origin of Species. It was better supported by the facts. And this, in a way, is where Louis's son, Alexander, comes into the story, because Alexander watched his father ride his method to the peak of American science, and then he watched him fall because of his tendency to extend his speculations too far and his willingness to press a beautiful, formalized story beyond what the facts that could support it. And Alex became determined to avoid those sort of excesses, and he conducted much of the rest of his life in a way that made it clear he was determined to avoid his father's mistakes, that he would not seek fame, and in fact avoided it. He would not speculate beyond the facts. He would build his theories a brick at a time, collecting as much evidence as was at all practical to collect, and then some, before he drew his conclusions. And this was really a only slightly extreme version of the scientific method as most people felt it should exist in the Victorian age. The problem with our hero Alexander was that for him, solving those questions of the scientific method were so inextricably bound up with the legacy, both personal and scientific, that his father left, that when he decided to try to resolve the coral reef question, he walked into really a maze with no exit, because the coral reef problem it presented tremendous logistical problems, tremendous problems of evidence collection, and even once you had all the evidence, tremendous problems in how to assemble that evidence into a coherent theory that could rest on the evidence. And it was further complicated by the fact that the prevailing theory of coral reef formation at the time had been posited by none other than Charles Darwin.
Hmm. And the son, Alexander, was a friend of Darwin's, although Darwin was much older than Alexander. Darwin and Louis Agassiz were contemporaries. But the son, Alexander, and Darwin developed almost like, I think you would describe it as a father-son relationship. But, you know, given what had happened to his father, how did that complicate Alexander's view of Darwin?
It complicated it immensely. you're right. Alexander did have a relationship with Darwin that was had an air of father and son to it, just as every naturalist and biologist of Alexander's generation did, because Darwin was the father of the biology that Alexander's generation practiced. He was and remains the father of modern biology. And Darwin recognized that and had tremendous admiration for Darwin's good work in creating his theory of species and in buttressing it with an insurmountable stack of evidence, which is why the only reason Alexander bought into it, just simply because the evidence outweighed the evidence supporting other theories. So here was Alex, in a sense, caught between two fathers, the highly conflicting legacy of two fathers who had had the biggest clash of the century in scientific terms over the species question, and whose methods also clashed, at least nominally. The Darwin, like many scientists of his time, professed to work in a highly empirical fashion. The fact is that Darwin was a highly imaginative scientist and theorist, and a very bold theorist. He was willing, in forming a theory, to jump out ahead of himself, and then to a brilliant idea that was a great leap of imagination. Such was his species theory, and such was his coral reef theory. Now, Alex's father, Louis, took issue with Darwin's species theory. The problem Louis ran into was that for 20 years after Darwin came up with his species theory, which was right after he came back from his voyage on the Beagle in the late 1830s, for 20 years, Darwin collected evidence to buttress his theory. And when he finally published it in 1859, the evidence he had amassed and that supported his argument for his theory were so strong that it quickly became the prevailing theory of species creation among scientists. With his coral reef theory, Darwin was quite a bit quicker to publish. He published his coral reef theory after seeing only a few coral reefs on the Pacific leg of the Beagle's voyage, and only months after he returned from the voyage. Now, it was 40 years later that Alexander Agassiz encountered this theory and decided to take issue with it. And one of the reasons he took issue with it, one of the reasons he disliked Darwin's coral reef theory when he approved of his evolutionary theory, is that he felt it rested on too little evidence. Not only that, most of the evidence that had been collected since 1836, when Darwin returned from the Beagle, and 1876, when Alexander Agassiz took up the coral reef question, most of the evidence collected since then seemed to argue against Darwin's coral reef theory. So here you had Alexander kind of trying to turn the tables on the man who, in a sense, slayed his father, who brought his father's fall about. And he was going to do it using Darwin's own tools, if you would, the tools of empirical proof. So you have a weird, I wouldn't quite call it an Oedipal tale, unless you want to decide that here Alex is out to kill his scientific father in revenge as a way of avenging his biological father. But your question was, how did it complicate his task? Mm-hmm. Well, you can see that it complicated his task immensely. He's at once trying to redeem his father somewhat by showing Darwin to be fallible, yet in trying to redeem his father and trying to prove Darwin is fallible, he's basically trying to show that Darwin made the same sort of mistake that Louis had made, that he had speculated too freely and overextended a theory beyond what the facts could support.
The problem with a leap of imagination from time to time. It can get you started, but then you have to back it up, and you can't play with the data.
Exactly.
So Alexander begins working on the coral question in 1876, and if I'm remembering correctly, Darwin dies in 1882. What was the relationship between the two men during this time, Alexander and Charles Darwin, as Alexander is working on the question?
It was quite cordial, and there's a chapter in the book that examines it mainly by looking at an exchange of letters between the two. And Darwin had met Alexander had met Darwin in 1870. This is before he took up the coral reef problem, before Alexander took up the coral reef problem, and while Louis was still alive. Louis died in 1873, which was another key event in this progression. At any rate, he had met Darwin twice, and they had really hit it off. And it was there in 1870 that Alexander confessed quietly to Darwin at his home that he was an evolutionist. He was a Darwinist in the sense of supporting his theory of evolution. This, as you can imagine, brought Darwin great delight. And this wasn't something that Alexander confided in very many people. He kept it very quiet because he didn't want it to become a public humiliation of his father. So the two got on quite well. They were essentially agreed about the way science should be practiced and what was important in science. And they were agreed that the coral reef problem was very important. And once Alexander took up the issue in the late 1870s, so he studied it for about 5 years while Darwin was still alive, five or six years while Darwin was still alive, Darwin played a strange role in Alexander's search for an answer here. He sort of gently prodded Alexander to look into the coral reef question more thoroughly. He kind of half admitted that he might have overlooked things, while at the same time stressing the strength of his theory. It was a weird sort of cat and mouse game that Darwin played with Alex, and Alex sensed that and responded in like kind, which is to say, with very gracious letters in return and a sort of fencing-like delicate clashing of swords, a tactical clashing of swords, if you would, over the evidentiary differences. And when you read those letters between the two, you sort of wonder if, had Darwin lived longer, if the two would have sort of begun to merge their perspectives in some way. because they did get along so well. They had so much respect for one another. And as long as Darwin was alive, Darwin's point of view could be represented by Darwin. And once he died, Darwin's cause, as it were, became defended by Darwin's supporters, who were a very vociferous, passionate crew with lacking Darwin's subtlety and humility for the most part. And Alexander didn't really care for most of these people. And his relationship with the Darwin legacy, as it were, became a bit more antagonistic.
Hmm. Give us some sense of these supporters of Darwin and how they turned up the heat on the coral reef question.
Well, Darwin supporters included some of the most eloquent people in British science, as well as American science. The great debate over evolution, for instance, in the United States, was primarily between Louis Agassiz and his colleague at Harvard, the botanist Asa Gray, who was a Darwin supporter and argued very successfully for Darwin's theory of evolution. When it came to Darwin's theory of coral reefs, he had sort of another generation of supporters over in Britain. And in the wake of Darwin's death, the coral reef question became a very large deal when an opponent of Darwin's, both in general and on the coral reef question, named the Duke of Argyll, the 8th Duke of Argyll, wrote an essay basically beating up on Darwin's theory and responding in support of Darwin and Darwin's theory was Thomas Huxley. Now, this is a man, students of the history of this time know, was known as Darwin's bulldog because Huxley had carried the charge in the public for Darwin's theory of evolution in the 1860s and early 1870s. And he was a brilliant scientist of his own right and a magnificent speaker and writer. And he was really the master of the quick comeback and so on. He, in a one of the famous bits that I relate in the book back from the argument over evolution, occurred when Thomas Huxley debated an archbishop over the evolution question. And the archbishop rather bitingly asked, as he finished his part of the debate, asked of Mr. Huxley, he wondered aloud whether Huxley descended from monkeys on his mother's side of the family or on his father's side of the family, which brought a great roar from the crowd, of course. Huxley got up and answered that he would rather have descended from apes than use the power of religion to misrepresent the facts, as he thought the archbishop had. And Huxley came to the defense of Darwin's coral reef theory, and this became known as a big fight. It was a huge fight that went on in the scientific journals in the during the 1880s over Darwin's coral reef theory, because at the time a friend of Alex's named Sir John Murray had proposed another opposing theory, and the Duke of Argyll's sort of inflammatory inflammatory article had accused Huxley and others of basically squashing Sir John Murray's alternate coral reef theory and called it a great conspiracy of silence. He felt that the Darwin establishment, as it were, was out to squish anything that opposed Darwin in any way. So Alex's quest for an alternative coral reef theory got caught up in this whole debate over whether Darwin's followers were suppressing other theories. And that is part of what made the coral reef issue such a high-profile question over the last quarter of the 19th century.
Hmm. Given Alex's temperament, how did he experience this huge, roaring debate around him?
Well, this was sort of his worst nightmare, in a sense, because he had seen what high-profile public debate did to both scientists and to science. He had seen a decade over which his father debated Asa Gray and other Darwin supporters, and he felt that the debate demeaned and harmed the people involved, and he felt that it also sort of oversimplified and therefore corrupted the actual scientific process by making it a sort of cult of personality and being a very reductive thing. So he was very averse to debate and perhaps to conflict in general because of his rather haunted personal past. By disposition, he didn't want anything to do with such a circus. So he tended to stay out of it directly. He did not, for instance, for couple of years, there was a heated and rapid exchange of letters in the scientific journal Nature over this coral reef issue and whether there was a conspiracy of silence. And pretty much everybody got involved in that except for Alex. He never wrote a letter into that debate. He sort of cheered Sir John Murray on from the side, but he did not enter into it. His style was more to just do the work and try to collect the facts. It was a very idealistic and arguably somewhat naive vision of how scientific ideas are actually debated and processed.
David Dobbs is our guest this afternoon here on The Afternoon Magazine. He's the author of Reef Madness, Charles Darwin, Alexander Agassiz, and The Meaning of Coral. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333, the number 333-9455. That's the entire number there, 333-WILL, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. You mentioned Alexander's haunted personal past. Maybe you'd give us a sense of his past and why he was such a different man from his father.
Yeah, he really had a rough go of it. As an adult, he was rather gruff and a bit withdrawn, although those close to him said he was extremely generous. And if he was withdrawn, it can be explained by the many terrific losses he had in his life. And his story as a youth really also, if you know a bit of it, you can see more how complicated his relationship with his father was. He was born in Switzerland, where Louis was working at the time. And by the time he was nine, Louis had gotten himself into various sorts of trouble in Europe, mainly by borrowing too much money and not being able to pay it back, and also in a few cases by having tiffs with other scientists over who was first with an idea, a scientific priority. And right about that time, in 1846, Louis was invited to the U.S. to lecture at Harvard, to give the Lowell lectures in Cambridge. And it was that led to Louis' immigration, moved to the United States, because he became a great hit and started making a lot of money and decided to stay here. He liked fame. Alex and his two younger sisters, however, were left behind in Switzerland along with their mother, Cecile Braun. And as bad luck would have it, Cecile Braun, the winter after Louis moved over to the U.S., became ill with what was probably TB, almost certainly TB, and died over this one long winter. When Alex, being the oldest in the house, he was only 12 then, he acted as the little man of the house and got the groceries and so on and tried to keep things going, but his mother passed away. So he lost his mother at a rather tender age of 12, and he was left in Europe with an uncle for another year before Louis arranged to have him brought over here to the United States. So this was an early scarring experience for him. And interestingly, Charles Darwin also lost his mother when he was young, at 8 years old. So Alex came over and did pretty well here in the United States, went to Harvard and became a very good student, naval scientist, and by the time he was in his early 30s, was working happily and was also very happily married to a woman named Anna Russell, and they had three young boys. And things were at that rather happy state in 1873 when Louis, with whom Alex worked every day at the Museum of Cooperative Comparative Zoology, Louis became ill. He had a stroke. And over an eight-day period in December of 1873, declined and finally died. This was a great loss, and it was just a few days before Alex's 37th birthday. A few days after his 37th birthday, rather incredibly, Alex lost his wife, Anna Russell, who had become ill tending Louis, and died 8 days later on the other side of Alex's 37th birthday. And Alex's friends, his best friend, said that Alex was, a light went out in his eyes when that occurred, and he was never quite the same. And if you read his letters, you see for at least 3 years afterwards, these are the letters of a man, someone whom today we would recognize as really dangerously, dangerously depressed. And he's rather staggered through those 3 years. And the thing that first drew him out and got him interested in life again was the coral reef theory that he encountered in 1876 when John Murray, his friend who had sailed around the world, presented an alternate theory to Darwin's, and Alex took up the job of proving it wrong.
Mm-hmm. We've got a couple of listeners waiting to talk with us. Let's go and talk with these folks. First, we're going to go to a listener in Indiana on line four. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
Two questions. One is, I'm presuming that the title of the book is a takeoff on a famous cult film called Reefer Madness. And I was wondering if you know about that, or whether you had no connection at all with what the publisher does at the time.
I have heard of the film. I don't think I've seen it.
Yeah,
but it is sort of in a tongue-in-cheek way. Yeah, obviously,
draws on that film. And that film was shown to young people throughout the United States. And when those people who had some stature experienced marijuana, and they saw the film, they realized that our elders were really sticking it to us in terms of what happens. One guy goes crazy after smoking one part of a J.
Right, I believe it was a sort of warning against drug film, highly traumatized.
Yeah, well, it's got a long history, too, just like this thing with Darwin
and
Agassiz. My second question was, way in the beginning you said something that the father disagreed with natural selection, and I presume since he was a creationist, it wasn't what we would say, quote-unquote, a scientific disagreement. I just wondered if you could expand on that a little bit. Thanks a lot.
Sure. Thank you for calling. Well, Louis certainly saw it as a scientific disagreement because he felt that his explanation, which was essentially that species were created by God exactly as we find them today, rather than that they were created through a random process, as Darwin's evolutionary theory has it. He felt that there was scientific proof of that, and that the proof was the very variety and pattern that Louis observed in nature. Now, the problem with that as a scientific explanation, of course, which we all see today, but at the time wasn't as apparent, was that Louis could not point to a natural process that could explain this. When you say God created something, and you don't add a process through which he does it, you don't really have something, you don't have a naturalistic explanation. And Louis had the misfortune of representing that point of view at a time when science itself was beginning to reject that sort of explanation. So Louis saw it as a scientific argument. We don't see it as so today, but that is primarily because Louis grew up and worked at a time when the definition of science was changing.
Let's talk with another listener, a caller in Charleston on line one. Hi.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Yes. I have two questions. The first is, did they know one another or any correspondence between Darwin and Karl Marx? And the other question is, Marx's famous take on Hegel's dialectic, did that fit into the quotient anywhere in the studies of, it almost seems a given, but I wonder if there's any history of that.
You mean did Marx's take on Hegel's dialectic feed into Darwin's theory?
Yes.
You've caught me in an area that I'm not terribly schooled. I don't know if Darwin and Karl Marx ever met. Whether they have or not, I'm surprised there's not a book on it yet. it's the kind of some thing someone would make up a meeting to write about if it hadn't occurred. As to the influence of Marx's and Hegel's thought on Darwin's theory, I must confess ignorance there, too. I don't. Doubtless people have looked into that, and there's been much written on it, but I myself have not covered that terrain.
I want to thank the listener for his questions this afternoon, and there we have to leave it. We've actually strayed a little bit past the time here this afternoon. David Dobbs, thank you very much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you.
David Dobbs is the author of Reef Madness, Charles Darwin, Alexander Agassiz, and The Meaning of Coral. The book is published by Pantheon. 9 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time, settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Another big day at the Chicago Board of Trade today. Futures in the
pit. Todd, hold on here. We're going to reintroduce you because we didn't have the correct thing dialed up here.
Oh, you could have just kept
there
going.
You go.
That's all right. From the Chicago Board of Trade, I'm Todd Gleason. I'm not at the board. I'm here in Ag Central at WILL. We have the numbers, though, and settlement prices from the Chicago Board of Trade. Big day there today as futures in the bean pit rallying again. A couple of things happening. The weather conditions continue to be dry and forecast continued dry weather across much of the growing regions down there. And then earlier in the week, and I picked this one up from Joe Victor in a conversation earlier today when he was talking about that 25-cent move earlier in the week. And part of that, apparently, as Paraguay had been set as a dry condition area as well. Now, Paraguay doesn't raise a lot of beans, but anything in a drought will do, won't it? So the numbers from the Chicago Board of Trade look like this in the bean pit. They were up about 30 cents across that floor. The nearby March contract, 28.5 higher. We'll get to those complete numbers momentarily. Let's take a look at what happened with the wheat for the day. March futures now, 324, the high, the low at 313.5 for the soft red winter wheat. And a settlement price for the soft red winter wheat March contract at the board, 323.25, and they were up 10.5 cents today following the bean pit higher. May futures, 334, the high, the low at 322.25, settled at 333.25, up 12. July up 11.5 today at 340 high. Low at 329.5, a settlement price there at 339.25. September futures, 344.5, the high, the low at 335, settled at 344. They were up 11 cents in December. Wheat up 10.5 today. 353, the high, the low at 343.5, a settlement price at $3.53. From the corn pit, futures anywhere from almost unchanged to up about 8 cents. The March contract for the day, 212.75, the high, the low, 206.5. Settled close to the high side at $2.11 a bushel for the March, up 5.75 for the day. For the corn, May futures, 223, the high, the low at 214.75. They settled 221.5. They were up 8 cents, and July corn up 6.75 today. 230.5, the high, the low at 222. Settled 227.5. They were up 6.75. September futures, 236, the high, the low at 228.75. September settled 234.5, up 6.75. And December contract for your new crop corn, 242, the high, the low at 236. And December 2005 corn settled 238.5, up 2.5 for the day. The March contract up 0.75 cents with a high of 247, a low at 43, and a settlement price close to the low at 243.5 for the March corn of 06. March soybeans, or rather March oats for the day now. 159.5, the high, the low at 156.75, settlement price at 157.5. They were up 1.25. And the May beans, or rather, I just want to jump to those numbers because they are so high. May oats, 150.5, the high, the low at 147, a settlement price at $1.47. They were up a half. Now the soy complex, bean futures, $5.99, the high, the low at 581, settled 597.5, up 28.5, almost made the $6 level today. May futures, 606, the high, the low at 587, settlement price at 604.5. They were up 30.5. And July soybeans, 610, the high, the low at 588, settled 608.5, and they were up 32 for the day. August soybeans, 607, the high, the low at 591, settled at 607, up 29.5 in the September futures, 603, the high, the low at $5.92, settled 604, they were up 28 cents. And November contract, your new crop beans, $6.10, the high, the low at 591, settlement price at 608, and they were up 26.5. We'll talk with Mike Zuzolo this afternoon and during the closing market report about 10 minutes away when we'll discuss all of what happened at Chicago Board of Trade and the reasons why. Soybean meal, March contract 179, the high, the low at 173, settled 178.20. They were up $8. May meal up 780, 180.50, the high, the low at 175, and a settlement price at 179.60. Once again, they were 780 higher for the day. March bean oil 22.55, the high, the low at $21.58, settled $22.54, up $1.21, and the Maybean oil, $22.82, the high, the low at $21.80, settlement price at $22.77, they were up $1.23 for the day. Now, with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange, here's Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, Todd. It looks like it was a mostly lower day today on the Mercantile Exchange. Feeder cattle and live cattle finished lower, and lean hogs were mixed. March feeders, 98.95 the high, 97.82.5 the low, the settlement 98.40, that down 67.5. April 97.85 the high, 96.75 the low, the settlement 97.62.5, that down 52.5. May 97.15 the high, the low 96.02.5, the settlement 96.92.5, that down 45. February live cattle 88.30 the high, 87.30 the low, 87.82.5 the settlement, that down 35. March 87 even the high, 85.90 the low, 85.90 the settlement, that down 140. April live cattle 86.20 the high, the low 85.30 the settlement 86.10, that down 17.5. April lean hogs 74.50 the high, 73.45 the low, the settlement 74.15, that down 75. May 76.30 the high, 75.37.5 the low, the settlement 76.10, that down 40. June lean hogs 79 even the high, 77.75 the low, the settlement 78.95, that up a nickel. July lean hogs 75.37.5 the high, 74.15 the low, 75.17.5 the settlement, that up 2.5. March pork bellies, today's high 87.45, the low 85.55, the settlement 87.40, that up 62.5. The Dow up 75 points at 10,824, the NASDAQ up 8 at 2059, and the S&P 500 up 10 points at 1210.
The Carl Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety is proud to underwrite agricultural programming on WILL. The center helps residents of rural communities with education and training in farm safety. For more information, call 217-383-4606.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Teresa Foster from Winters, California writes, "Dear Dr. Science, my husband is a loyal fan of yours. He listens to your show, Rain or Shine. As a concerned wife, I have one question for you. Is Dr. Science addicting?"
Not that I know of, but Dr. Science is himself an addict. Yes, I confess, I'm addicted to quite a few things. Truth, justice, science. If I can't have my daily fix of disseminating the truth to the ignorant masses, of promoting the equality and